I don't understand the question. If it's not legal...
If it's like sort of like the argument where it's like...
if it's illegal, it's not illegitimate?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't... yeah, I think that theoretically, of course, that's a possibility. If something is... There's a lot of things that we've made illegal that are not necessarily illegitimate. It's illegal to marry a Palestinian and live... For a Palestinian in Haifa to marry a Palestinian in the West Bank and live in Israel proper, that doesn't mean it's an illegitimate concept. Theoretically, that holds water. That's not the point, right? And I think that's a rhetorical tool. That doesn't matter. What does matter is Israel, look, all states, part of what all states have done as being part of being a state is that you have many rights and duties, but you also have obligations, right? You have privileges to protect yourself as a sovereign state, but you also have obligations to protect your citizens. One of the things right now, the concept of the responsibility to protect that was invoked in the case of the NATO intervention in Syria, is that sovereignty flows from responsibility. If Libya cannot be responsible for its civilian population, then it no longer has the privilege of sovereignty of its borders. That's something under international law was an argument that was made. The point is that all states are subject to international law of what's legal and what's not, what they can do and what they cannot, and what they owe their populations. In the case of Israel, it's not about legitimacy or illegitimacy as regards international law, right? That's a moral concept, and we can talk about that. But as regards international law, Israel is in violation of the law as evidenced by the UN Security Council, by the International Court of Justice, by the Are you familiar with the treaty-making bodies in Geneva? The treaty-making bodies in Geneva correspond to each of the human rights treaties that you know. The Treaty on the Convention Against Torture, the Treaty on the Convention for the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the International Covenant on Economic, Social, Cultural Rights, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. How many of you know anything about human rights? I know Tariq probably does. So these are human rights treaties. They're agreements between states. And in order to oversee them, because we don't have something like an international court that has the police power to enforce it, aside from Chapter 7 authority within the UN Security Council, there are committees comprised of states that oversee compliance with these human rights laws. Within these committees, the committees have consistently found that Israel is in violation of those rights. This is not contestable. The only reason Israel has not been held to account is because the U.S. offers it impunity within these different bodies. The U.S., after the passage of the ICJ decision in 2004, passed a congressional resolution condemning the advisory opinion, saying that it violated Israel's right to defend itself. Between, I think, and don't quote me on this, but between 1978 and 2008, the U.S. has vetoed 43 of the 75 or so resolutions the Security Council has proposed to hold Israel to account. 43 of the 75. The U.S. has been able to shield Israel from accountability when it came to the 2008-2009 Gaza offensive known as Operation Cast Lead. And as a result of its pressure, the Human Rights Council wasn't able to hold Israel to account for that. What would it have done? It would have created a fund for the victims to rehabilitate them. It would have demanded an end to the siege around Gaza. And it would have prosecuted, more likely, if Israel couldn't prosecute its own soldiers, which it has proven unable and unwilling to do, it would have referred those cases to the International Criminal Court. That's what accountability looks like. That's how all states are policed in an international system. So I'm not really sure what the legitimacy or illegitimacy matters in a case of an international system subject to international law imposed upon all states, and that's just not imposed upon Israel, which can be above the law because of the U.S.'s protection. Libya and Syria, for example, don't benefit from that protection. Saudi Arabia, Yemen to a certain extent, do benefit from that protection. So this is not just about Israel being the one bad player. Most states are bad players. But most states, or a majority of them, are held to account, unlike Israel, which has never been. Right. So, if you didn't hear the question, it was about even within Israel, not just the distinction between Jewish and non-Jewish citizens, even between its Jewish population, that not all people are treated equally. I want to say two things about this point. The first is, I think all societies, most of them, have an inherent racist approach to the organization of their population. Right? Institutional discrimination against its own populations, including in Arab states, including in the United States. Nobody has this perfect utopia of racial equality. The reason that this internal distinction, but that is to be distinguished from an institutionalized system like apartheid and Jim Crow and like what Israel practices, which is a combination of apartheid and ongoing settler colonialism, is to be distinguished from that. Because here we're basing it just on two groups that don't have access to certain laws. Israel and its discrimination of its own citizens, its Jewish citizens, right? So it's Jewish nationals. It doesn't have perfect equality, and it does have a hierarchy. And I do think that that's not unique to Israel. The reason it's significant to discuss in this context is because of the way that Israel has been mythologized by the United States, especially as a beacon of democracy and civilization, where it's forgiven of all its wrongs. It's forgiven of misogyny amongst its extremist Jewish populations. It's forgiven for its attacks on Ethiopian Jews and sterilization without consent. Ethiopian Jews who were immigrating to Israel to become Israeli citizens were given Depo Provera without their consent, which prevents them from becoming pregnant for at least 3 months, if not more, at a time. So you can't say it sterilized them for life, but there was a form of sterilization. Israel also treats its Mizrahi community. So it has different communities. There's an Ashkenazi community, a Mizrahi community, a Russian community, an Ethiopian community. These are all distinguished and treated differently. A Sephardim community, where this of Spanish descent. The Mizrahim, which means middle in Hebrew, the Mizrahim are those who are Arab Jews. Are the Arabs, Arab Jews who've become Israeli citizens from Yemen and Morocco and Syria and Iraq and Iran, right? And they are treated completely differently and very discriminatorily. In fact, they're located, the majority of them, in Sderot and in other areas, for example, that are the most vulnerable to rocket and border fire, right? They are located in the north. In Israel's establishment, and I don't have these quotes to underscore these points, but in Israel's establishment, it very much wanted to create a European conception of itself that was dominated by whiteness. And so the Mizrahim, its own Jewish national citizens, would have to be subject to a racialization process, and so in many ways they had to be de-Arabized. And this is an explicit program that the state undertook in its inception. So, yes, there is explicit discrimination in the hierarchy within even Jewish national and citizens amongst their society. That hierarchy is not very distinct from the hierarchy we have in other societies. It is unique because of the way that Israel is mythologized, and so I appreciate the question, but also to add that that's to be distinguished from something like apartheid and colonialism, which not all societies exercise. Well, Israel in its inception wanted a state that would be a reflection of Europe in the Middle East. Does it now, it's trying to diminish? For example, consider this. In the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union, approximately 1 million Russians immigrated to Israel. Many of them are not Jewish, right? But have not been subject to the same discriminatory and harassing treatment that Ethiopian Jews have been subject to. And that has been absolutely an outcome of racism. Yes. How does Israel want to limit that population? It's been very explicit. It doesn't want its African population, who it considers dirty, filthy, the epithets you would associate with racial hierarchies, but it's also not deporting them en masse, although it tried. Israel did try to deport its Ethiopian Jewry at one point, and there were internal legal efforts to prevent that, an injunction to prevent that. But the last point I want to say here is that if we want to imagine a future here, the Mizrahim have also been victims of Zionism in many ways because of its attempt to erase their history and to de-Arabize them altogether in an effort to create a new ethno-national mythology of self. Is that helpful? No. So Plan D or Plan Dalit was the actual architecture, the plan to remove Palestinians, the 700,000, from Palestine?
Yeah.
I was just explaining to her. Yeah, no worries. And so the question is, can I imagine the forcible displacement of Israel's non-Jewish citizens in the future? No, not like that. I don't think that Israel can afford that. However, there is an open discussion of the explicit transfer of those Palestinians without. So that if there was a Palestinian state established, the majority of Jews support the open transfer of the Palestinian citizens of Israel. And so that has been discussed very explicitly. But I don't think that we're going to see a forced removal. There's discussion of land swaps, so that if there is a two-state solution, that the settlements are swapped for the Palestinian majority lands within Israel, so that you somehow try to achieve some sort of ethno-national purity. There is that discussion, but Israel is much, much, much more subtle in regard to its internal population, even though it's uprooting its Palestinian population in the Negev. It's not uprooting them without the border. They're uprooting them to an urban township, which is equally problematic. And the discourse around it, the Israeli apologist discourse, is, well, they're just trying to help them to modernize, to modernize these Bedouins in the civilizational discourse. But laws that you see, like the ban on family reunification, the inability for Palestinians within Israel to expand naturally by population growth, for their communities to expand, that makes them, that ghettoizes them. So that they either are forced to leave, or even if they stay, they remain really overpopulated in certain areas that are surrounded by Jewish-only communities around them in ways that create the equivalent to what we see in the West Bank. So I just don't imagine under what circumstances Israel would be that brazen. Although, you know, crazier things have happened, so I wouldn't discount it. Huh? It was brazen in Gaza. That was in Gaza, absolutely. I'm going to take new hands and then I'll come back around.
Could you expand on the concept of transfer?
So forced population transfer under international law is the legal way of saying ethnic cleansing. So there's nothing polite about transfer. To discuss transfer and the transfer of land or land swaps is somehow to sterilize these very violent processes and concepts. And so the proposals today are to, said in another way, to ethnically cleanse Israel of its non-Jewish population. And even land swaps are illegal under international law. There's something significant about the partition plan of the UN Resolution 181, which proposed to partition, mandate Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. This is 1947. The two-state solution is not like the partition plan. The partition plan is preferable. The partition plan had a non-discrimination clause that stipulated that all Jews who remained in the Arab states would not be discriminated against based on religion. And all Arabs who remained in the new Jewish state would not be discriminated against in their new state. So even UN Resolution 181 did not envision this type of ethno-national separation, extrication, movement towards purity that the two-state solution proposes. But even that has failed. Even that has failed, as you saw with the APN's map. What the future holds is certainly not going to be pleasant. The Israeli population, having never been subject to accountability, feels that it's been victimized when the world talks about it as a rogue state in violation of international law, that somehow everybody is picking on Israel. That's generations and generations that have no idea what Palestinian history is, similar to our generations and generations who may not acknowledge the violence of slavery and who do not acknowledge that we may be standing on stolen land right now, right? I'm not saying something brazen to say that Israeli society has no idea, for the most part, that they are in fact committing these crimes. It's going to take generations of re-educating generations to make that clear, and some Israeli organizations are invested in that, like organizations like Zuchrot, which means memory in Hebrew, whose purpose is to teach Israeli society about the Nakba, or the Palestinian catastrophe. Their job is to take Jewish Israelis on walking tours throughout Israel to show them where Palestinians lived. That's part of the steps forward. But also nothing Nothing will be possible without accountability, where Israel as a state cannot continue the violence that it subjects Palestinians to. Are you equating the KLA to the Irgun?
There are clear connections there, the system.
I see a lot of similarities, and here I'm going to go, but I don't know about that specific reference, so I'm going to extrapolate one level of abstraction. To go back to the first comment that I made about the fact that it's not that international law is broken. It's that its implementation is contingent on state action, and states act in their political interest. And so if we want to see international law is only as strong as the political will that underpins it. And in this case, we have not developed the sufficient political will to impose these concepts in the conflict in Israel and Palestine. And in large measure, that we probably would have but for the U.S.'s stonewalling that accountability in the Security Council. But I also mentioned that in 2009, the Sri Lankan army nearly annihilated its Tamil population in very inhumane ways and has not been held to account sufficiently, and there is no international criminal court to hold it to account, as I think should have been. But that also speaks to the political will to do so. Who wants to represent the Tamils? Who wants to risk that political capital? So these are also political considerations. And in the former Yugoslavia, and in specifically the International Criminal Tribunal on Yugoslavia, I think that the cases themselves, the criminals that were tried, that those laws, based on what I've read and seen and quantitative studies, that there have actually been fair trials. However, do I think that everybody that was worthy of prosecution was tried? No, absolutely not. And so who is tried and who's not tried also reflects power and state relations. One more thing on this. So the 90s was a moment of a lot of hope around defending people against states. It was in the aftermath of Rwanda, the aftermath of the Yugoslavia, breakup of the Yugoslavia, and we saw these two international criminal tribunals created. The Rome Statute is written in 1998. It's ratified by 2003. We established the International Criminal Court. This is like the heyday of individual rights against state rights. But since then, there's been a very strong contraction, so that the rights of states, which, by the way, are often in tension with the rights of individuals that live within those states, have now have been gaining in force. But what we're seeing in the Middle East, especially as a result of the Arab Spring, is also reconfiguring that. So it's a very dynamic process. None of this is static. And so I do think that there's a possibility to hold Israeli officials to account. I worked with the Center for Constitutional Rights and cooperating attorneys in the U.S. to hold them to account under the Alien Tort Statute in U.S. federal courts, against Avi Dichter for the dropping of a one-ton bomb in Gaza, Salah Hashadeh, the extrajudicial assassination of Salah Hashadeh, which killed 14 people and demolished 8 homes near him, as well as the prosecution of Moshe Alon, who oversaw the bombing of a UNIFIL headquarter in Qana, Lebanon, in 1996. In violation of international criminal law. Both cases were dismissed without review of any of the merits. They were dismissed on jurisdictional grounds, but for political question, for foreign sovereign immunity, U.S. Judges felt that that was something to be left to their executive branch to decide. Although U.S. judges have prosecuted Serbian officials, they've prosecuted Filipino officials, Guatemalan officials, and Chinese officials, but they did not charge Israeli officials. If the Palestinian Authority, which now has standing as a state, at least recognition as a state, they could take this case to the International Criminal Court. They could prosecute Israel there. They have not done so. That's on that leadership. So my voice is, it's actually becoming really hard for me to talk. So maybe I'll take one more question. That is a great question. Oh, I'm so glad I get to finish on this note. Hold on. The question is, it's quite insurmountable. Why would we even try? When are we going to ever finish? We can say that if we are considering these changes happening within our lifetime, or even in the span of two generations, but we can't possibly have that conception. We have to think of this as something that's in constant evolution. We're never going to get to that perfect place, but we're getting farther and farther away from the tyranny of power and anarchy among states. So that the law of self-defense, which is today enshrined in Article 2.4 of the UN Charter, which prohibits the use of force by states, and then Article 51, which provides its sole exception in the case of self-defense, before the establishment of this law of self-defense, states could use force against other states for all reasons. For revenge, for deterrence, for being able to establish whatever means they wanted politically. So what is war? War is politics, but by military means. If you cannot come to a resolution politically to negotiate power, then you use the power of military force to resolve that outstanding question. And states have historically done exactly that. Which is not to say that they stop doing it once we abolish the use of force or limit it, curtail it by the law of self-defense. But it has become something that's subject to law that constrains states and shapes their behavior. States, even if they're not held to account necessarily in all cases, do change their behavior. Ideally, we'd live in a world without states at all. Ideally, there would be no states that can impose borders. There would be no stateless people who have no rights anywhere. There would be no such thing as refusing a refugee at one's borders. As Jordan is doing now to Palestinian refugees fleeing Syria in the name of state sovereignty. I think that the state breeds many of these problems. But the state is also a recent concept. The nation state is a 20th century concept. And in 1901, there were only 43 states in the world. Today, does anybody know the answer? 193. 43 states in 1901 or 3, and 193 states today. Why? Because in the aftermath of World War II, the right to self-determination became a right of all peoples to be able to shake off the rule, to be able to shake off colonial rule. And to rule oneself as a nation state. So this concept is very recent. It's very new. And yet already we see it shifting in a myriad of ways. And I absolutely believe that we're going to continue to see a shift with the expansion of the rights of individuals under international law. Before the Holocaust, individuals had very few rights under international law, and international law and human rights only referred to the rights of states. After the Holocaust, when the massacre of Jews evidenced that individuals are absolutely powerless without some sort of state protection, that international law must also protect them, that they can have rights, and that, those are exactly what human rights are. Human rights refers to the rights of individuals even if they don't have a state. You don't have to be a citizen to have human rights. And that space for the rights of individuals, as a rights bear, for the individual as a rights-bearing agent under international law, is continuously expanding. And I think that that expansion is what constricts the rights of states as we find balance and dynamism. So no, I don't think that international law is perfect, and I don't think that it's absent of all these politics. Do I think that I should throw it out and resort to the force of arms in order to resolve all conflicts in the blatant use of power? I see you both nodding. Absolutely not. Because the victims of that outcome will be civilians and the people with the least protection, poorest members of society who are marginalized, who are the unwanted. No, I don't think that's the outcome I want to see.